Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and it's pretty rare for Supreme Court justices to speak in public. And while they write a lot of what they think in their opinions, sometimes you have to wait until they retire to hear what they really think about underlying issues and tensions on the court, ideological and constitutional. For that reason, a lot of people are noticing the commencement address that retired Justice David Souter gave at Harvard last week. It was his first real coming out since he left the court last year, and he used the occasion to pounce on the idea that the job of a Supreme Court justice is simply to give a fair reading of the Constitution. This was the position, of course, that Chief Justice John Roberts took at his confirmation hearing when he said the only job of a justice is to be an umpire, not a player. Well, it's been a bad week for the idea of the infallible umpire, as we learned in baseball from Jim Joyce in that perfect game blown call. And now in this takedown of the fair reading umpire model by Justice Souter. Souter used two classic rulings as his examples, the Pentagon Papers case and Brown versus Board of Education, which was, of course, the landmark civil rights decision from 1954 that outlawed public school segregation, striking down the notion of separate but equal schools as a discriminatory fiction. So we're going to play a four-minute excerpt now from his section on Brown. Souter argues here that the fair reading umpire model would have been inadequate to the task because of what Souter calls the subtlety of constitutional facts.
Brown ended the era of separate but equal, whose paradigm was the decision in 1896 of the case called Plessy and Ferguson. And in that case, the Supreme Court had held it was no violation of equal protection to require black people to ride in a separate railroad car that was physically equal to the car for whites. One argument that had been offered in Plessy was that the separate black car was a badge of inferiority. And to that, the court majority responded at the time that if black people viewed it that way, the implication was merely a product of their own minds. 60 years later, Brown held that a segregated school required for black children was inherently unequal. For those whose exclusive norm of constitutional judging is merely fair reading of language applied to facts subjectively viewed, Brown must be either flat-out wrong or a very mystifying decision. Those who tend to look to that model are unlikely to think that a federal court back in 1896 should have declared legally mandated racial segregation unconstitutional. But if Plessy was not wrong, how is it that Brown came out so differently? The language of the Constitution's guarantee of equal protection of the laws did not change between 1896 and 1954. And it would be very hard to say that the obvious facts on which Plessy was based had changed. While Plessy was about railroad cars and Brown was about schools and schoolrooms, that distinction was no great difference. And actually, the best clue to the difference between the cases is the dates they were decided, which I think lead to the explanation for their divergent results. As I have said elsewhere, the members of the court in the Plessy case remembered the day when human slavery was the law in much of the land. To that generation, the formal equality of an identical railroad car meant enormous progress. But the generation in power in 1954 looked at enforced separation without the revolting background of slavery to make it look unexceptional by contrast. As a consequence, the judges in 1954 found a meaning in segregation that the majority of their predecessors in 1896 simply did not see. That meaning is not captured by descriptions of physically identical schools or physically identical railroad cars. The meaning of facts arises elsewhere, and its judicial perception turns on the experience of the judges and on their ability to think from a point of view that is different from their own. Meaning comes from the capacity to see what is not, in some simple objective sense, there on a printed page. And when the judges of 1954 read the record of enforced segregation, it carried only one possible meaning to them. It expressed a judgment of inherent inferiority on the part of the minority race. And the judges who understood the meaning that was apparent in 1954 would have violated their oaths to uphold the Constitution if they had not held the segregation mandate unconstitutional. Again, a rhetorical question. Did the judges of 1954 cross some limit of legitimacy into lawmaking by stating a conclusion that you will not find written in the Constitution? Was it activism to act based on the current meaning of facts that at a purely objective level were about the same as Plessy's facts 60 years before? Again, of course, you know my answer. And so much for the assumption that facts just lie there waiting for an objective judge to view them.
Retired Supreme Court Justice David Souter, from his Harvard commencement speech last week. If you want to see the whole speech, we put a video of it on our page. You can go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to react to what you just heard, we have time for a few calls at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And joining us is the former longtime Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times, Linda Greenhouse, who blogged about the speech on the Times Opinionator blog. She is a lecturer these days at the Yale Law School, and her most recent book is Before Roe v. Wade, Voices That Shaped the Abortion Debate Before the Supreme Court's Ruling. Hi, Linda. Welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, thanks very much, and thanks for letting me listen to that again.
Yeah, well, it's quite a speech, and his reading of the progression of thinking on separate but equal is that pretty much accepted wisdom? The reasons that Plessy and Brown came out differently, even though they were based on the same set of facts?
Well, I think, you know, people usually are much more sort of angrily dismissive of Plessy against Ferguson because its holding seems so preposterous in light of today. But I think what's really distinctive about the way Justice Souter framed that part of his discussion about how to interpret the Constitution is that he quite empathetically put himself back in the position of the justices in 1896 who had grown up in the era of slavery and who plausibly could have thought, well, you know, equal is a whole lot better than what it was before.
That was fascinating. A very, you know, in right-left terms, maybe a very conservative reading because of how sympathetic it was to Plessy as separate but supposedly equal railroad cars looking okay shortly after slavery.
Oh, well, I don't think, you know, not to quarrel with you, but I don't think right-left is the way to look at this. It's rather then and now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, 19th century, well, you know, I mean, half a generation earlier, people were in chains, and now they're riding in a railroad car that's the same as...
But if Justice Scalia or Justice Roberts heard that speech, do you think they would have agreed with his, you know, demolition of the fair reading model of being a Supreme Court justice based on that example?
Oh, well, I think, you know, I think they're pretty sure of their own position. And I think, I mean, I have no idea whether they heard the speech, read the speech, or how they would have responded. But certainly from Justice Scalia's own writing, he has taken the position that any time a judge strays from the, quote, original meaning or the text of the Constitution, the judge opens himself or herself up to
But what would the alternative explanation be from Scalia or someone of the fact that separate but equal was found constitutional in Plessy and unconstitutional 60 years later in Brown?
Well, there's the famous confession of error that Baron Bramwell of the English courts once made, which is that the matter does not appear to me now as it appears to have appeared to me then. You know, I don't think today's justices have really been tasked with explaining the trajectory from Plessy to Brown. And what's really notable about Justice Souter's speech is that he dissects that trajectory as a way of really talking about the present. I mean, he's not presenting himself as a, you know, historian, but he's saying, look, it's not correct to say that facts are facts and we simply apply the law to the facts, because I mean, what's key to his analysis is he said what may look like objective facts are really infused with context and meaning from the world in which those facts emerge. And so it's his understanding of how when he says the meaning of facts arises elsewhere than the printed page, you know, where does it arise? It arises from the judge's understanding of the current world based on that judge's life experience and perspective.
In reinforcing the importance of diversity on the Supreme Court.
Well, yes, and the importance of recognizing that to invoke something as objectively correct and base a decision on that, you know, can really hide a whole lot of other issues. And, you know, what's the meaning of facts? I mean, the book that you mentioned that my co-author Reva Siegel and I just published before Roe Against Wade. I mean, one thing, as I was re-listening to Justice Souter's speech, I was thinking the meaning of the word abortion and the meaning of the facts surrounding abortion changed dramatically during the decade before Roe Against Wade. It changed from a public health issue at the beginning of the 1960s to an issue that carried with it a whole lot of baggage about families and the role of women and sexuality and all kinds of other stuff that has made the issue so contentious, you know, even today, 37 years after Roe. But it was the meaning of abortion that evolved and changed. And that's the way things work.
Let me give voice to one caller here before we run out of time. Nia in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nia. We'll have to keep this to about 40 seconds.
I was privileged many years ago to have one of my poems called The Learning Gate published in the Harvard Educational Review. It was published and then in a book. But what I wanted to say is this. I think the question of issue of justice has to do with contextual clues. The clues for my great-great-grandparents in 1820, when they were born in Bedford in Campbell County, Queen Preston, and Betty Terry, were segregation and slavery. The context when I was five in 1954 and 1957 was one that justice was being demanded and humanity was being looked at in a whole different way. I was privileged to go to an integrated high school, but some kids are not going to integrated high schools in New York. I think the Constitution is a valuable document, but don't forget that my ancestral heritage in Africa meant I was three-fifths of a person. Was that just and human? I think we're living in the shadow of the death of so many people that we have to understand that do you like what you see when you look at me? That's the first phrase of my poem. And we knew that they didn't like us, but you've got to treat us with humanity.
Nia, thank you so much. And that, appropriately enough, is going to be the last word. We thank Linda Greenhouse for adding her comments to the speech excerpt that we played from retired Justice David Souter in a Harvard commencement address last week. Linda's book is Before Roe versus Wade, Voices That Shaped the Abortion Debate Before the Supreme Court's Ruling. And she is a lecturer at the Yale Law. What, you couldn't get him at Yale, Linda? Oh, Linda's gone. All right. Yale Law School lecturer, former longtime Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times, Linda Greenhouse. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And again, if you want to see a video clip of that full speech by retired Justice Souter, we have it on our site. Go to WNYC.org. click on Brian Lehrer Show.